social housing policy and then to go through the various chapters of the social housing bill as such. To start with, in South Africa, we are sitting with a dilemma in the rental housing market where currently the market is essentially dysfunctional. And if you look at the migration patterns, the rapid urbanization, the projected data which shows us that a third of low-income renters in metro areas are staying in backyard shacks and informal settlements, and looking at the profile also in the lower income groups who are looking for affordable rental. And if we were to meet that demand, we would need to be delivering approximately 100,000 units per annum to meet the rental housing demand of just that income group. So we've come to the conclusion, and definitely seen the rental housing market as it stands at the moment, it's a dysfunctional market. It definitely needs some intervention to correct the situation that exists, to allow access for people in the lower income group and to address issues of affordability. Before I dive too deep in rental, and the main formula that exists for rental is the fact that there's a tenant, there's rent that needs to be paid, and there's a unit. Why I bring in the slide is that often there are these interruptions to the formula, let me say. People try to change a tenant to an owner when a tenant should remain a tenant. The rent becomes debatable. When you're renting a unit, you need to pay rent. So we state up front when we talk about rental housing, we have a tenant who pays rent to occupy a unit. So essentially this accommodation is not free accommodation. There's definitely an exchange of rent. In exchange for that rent, the tenant gets the use of the unit and he gets certain services for a period of time. And quite critically, in all of the programs, the policies and social housing, this formula is maintained and upheld so that we don't get problems between tenants, landlords and so on at the end of the day. But we stated up front just to give it emphasis again. Essentially, looking at the rental housing market, on page 3, the bottom slide, you'll find there's a public housing market, which is your typically government-owned rental housing stock, and then there's a private housing market, which are owned by, it's properties owned by private companies that are let out. Those companies could either be for-profit or non-profit, but essentially we have a public and a private rental housing market. You will very well know that most of the government-owned rental housing stock, the flats, the hostels, those kind of accommodations, those are dysfunctional. They're not working in the way that those markets should work, so there's an intervention required in the public market. There's definitely a clear distinction between public rental and private rental. In the private rental, I've already sketched the fact that there aren't a lot of formal opportunities, and then access and affordability to those formal opportunities are limited. Hence, one needs an intervention into the private market. And we're looking at a process where, ultimately, for rental housing, we want access for lower and indigenous income groups. We need to scale it up so that there are more formal opportunities for rental housing. So looking at that scenario, the next slide on page 4 at the top shows you our proposed strategy on how to deal with this. On the one hand, for the private rental housing market, we're proposing this social housing instrument as such, as being the intervention into the private rental housing market. As an instrument, the social housing program and policy allows for access for lower income groups while still maintaining the dynamic element of the private rental housing market. In the public rental housing market, we've proposed a program called Community Residential Units, or CRU for short. CRU deals with only subsidized income groups, the very low income groups, and it's primarily an intervention in the public rental housing environment. The way we've designed the two programs, both social housing and CRU, is that the one facilitates and complements the other. So there is an overlap of income groups between the programs, which has been done on purpose, because we typically see that a informal tenant, if you like, someone staying in a backyard rental, someone staying in an informal settlement, could come into a public rental housing opportunity, move on in the spectrum, and eventually move into a private rental housing opportunity, and from there enter into the housing market, the other ownership opportunity. So we designed the two programs to work together. Social housing, looking at an income group, 1,500 all the way up to about 7,500. CRU, looking at an income group of 3,500 rand a month, and as low as a local authority can go from that income group down to indigenous groups. So the two are complementary, and they are two mainstream programs that we're using to intervene into the two parts of the rental housing market, but also to bring those two markets together. On page 4 at the bottom, I outline in brief how the two programs work, where I indicate social housing is for private sector, for-profit and non-profit companies, and it's to mobilize those role players. It's all about cross-subsidization. It's about mobilizing private funders to invest in rental housing accommodation. It's got restructuring objectives, which I'll explain a little bit more. It's targeting your lower and middle income groups, as I indicated, from 7,500 all the way down to 1,500 rand a month. And it's an object subsidy, which means the money is going into the building. It's not money that goes into people's hands or into a landlord's hands. The money we provide through this program goes into the actual physical structure. So it's an object subsidy that we're providing. Community residential units, which is a complementary program. It is about correcting historical problems with public housing and hostels. It's about creating a coherent framework for public housing and hostels to bring them together into one program and then to bring them to the private market so that we stabilize and equalize these two markets so that they work with one another. CRU is addressing your indigent and lower income groups, so it targets people earning 3,500 Rand all the way down to 800 Rand a month, and in some cases it can even go lower than that. It stabilizes the market and the housing environment. It addresses slum landlords in terms of providing an alternative choice for those residents instead of going to, say, informal rental accommodation. It's affordable formal accommodation for informal tenants. And then again, it's an object subsidy, so the money goes into the building. Largely, it's not money to subsidize the tenant or to subsidize the landlord at the end of the day. So those, in brief, are the two programs. For today, and focusing on the social housing bill, I'm only looking at the one side. But I would like you to know that there is the other side to rental housing, another program that is run that also deals with your lower income groups as well. But the policy and the bill focus on the social housing element, which is an intervention in the private rental housing market, essentially. On page 5, also a key element that I would like you to bear in mind. We've got the social housing bill, which will eventually become an act, hopefully, is a piece of framework legislation. Basically, it does fall and is alongside the Housing Act, which exists. So it has already been aligned and put to in line with the Housing Act. Underneath the Housing Act, there is a social housing policy, which I spoke about, which I'll speak about in a few minutes. That policy has guided the nature and the form of this bill. So the policy is there, and then it frames what is required to be put into the social housing bill as such. Underneath the social housing bill, there will still be regulations. There will be regulations for the regulator that we're proposing in the bill, as well as other regulations for managing the sector. And possibly even under those regulations for the regulator we're proposing, there will be operational policies and procedures and rules that will get published. So you won't see the regulations, the rules, the operational procedures in the bill itself or the act. It comes into the pieces of legislation that follow the bill itself. The social housing bill is therefore setting the framework, and underneath it is the regulation, and underneath that could be further rules and operational procedures for the entity we're proposing. Alongside the act, there is also a set of program guidelines. And this is information that doesn't necessarily have to be legislated, and it facilitates the actual running of the program. And those guidelines are again guided by the social housing policy. So both the bill and the guidelines are framed by the social housing policy, which is framed by the Housing Act, which is framed by BNG as such. So again, you won't see certain elements that are in the policy captured in the bill, because the bill is just trying to capture the essence of what needs to be legislated at the end of the day to make the program and the sector work. To then touch base on the social housing policy before I go into the bill. The social housing policy, upfront when we developed it as an intervention in the private rental housing market. What makes this program different from any other government program at this point in time is that it's mixing government grants, private sector money, and equity in order to produce the product, the rental product that's put on the market. So where all the other government programs are just a grant that is provided for a complete product, the social housing program has private sector funding and equity invested in the product as well as government grants. So in order to protect that investment of government as well as the private sector, we needed to legislate and put a regulator in place to look after that investment and to give comfort to the private sector to invest in the sector. It focuses on drawing in and involving the private sector. We didn't want to intervene in the private rental housing market and exclude the private sector, so we're actually trying to bring them in and mobilize them to help us to address the rental housing challenges. We've designed the instruments for the social housing policy and program to ensure maximum cross-subsidization from higher and middle income groups to support the lower income groups. So you'll find, in essence, middle income people staying in the social housing pay more rent, and that extra rent that they're paying subsidizes and covers the cost of the lower income groups. That's what I mean by cross-subsidization. The government grant that is used to build the product is then cross-subsidized with public investment. So you're making the government's money more with that private sector investment and funding in the product. So there's different elements of cross-subsidization to make this product affordable and accessible for lower income groups. It's not proposed that social housing become a mass delivery instrument. It's rather a targeted and focused program, and we've done that again on purpose. We've said social housing, it can be done on mass or it can be targeted. If it's targeted, it becomes very strategic, and it actually creates a dynamic in the market that allows for access and affordability in areas where there wouldn't typically have been this access for the lower income groups. So we targeted and focused it strategically in specific areas. We call those areas restructuring zones. And basically, the program is focused. You put social housing in there, some CRU gets built as a result, and some other rental housing gets built, and you get the spin-off effect of that intervention, whereas if the social housing was never there, you wouldn't have had that change happening in the rental housing market in those areas. Restructuring objectives I'll speak about in a minute, because that's key to how we target the social housing program. Essentially, it's about focusing on areas where the market is not working from an economic point of view, from a social point of view, and from an integration point of view. So these restructuring objectives are to promote integration at the end of the day, but I'll go into it in more detail. The definition of social housing has been crafted in the policy, and again, it's reflected in the bill. So the definition from the policy has been carried to the bill. And the definition basically says that social housing is a rental or cooperative housing option. Quite specifically here, cooperatives are referring to housing cooperatives, and they are long-term cooperative tenure that one is looking at, and cooperative institutional form. But again, if you require more information on cooperatives, let me know. But for the moment, it's allowing a rental or leasehold tenure form as well as a cooperative tenure form. It's a housing option, and that's again to indicate that a person can choose this option, or they can choose to go and own, or they can choose to take one of the other subsidy programs. So this is not a mass program. It is an option for people to choose. It's targeted to low-income persons, and again, we specifically defined low-income persons and not poor persons, because ultimately the person who stays in this accommodation would have to pay rent. It's not free accommodation. And then it's required at the level of scale and built form that requires institutional management. So it's a property that must have some management agent managing it. If, for example, a house where people are sharing communally, that doesn't require a management agent to manage it. But in the case of social housing, it will be at a scale and form where you require a management agent to manage it. And you'll see the bill is all about managing that management agent and checking the management agent does what he's supposed to do. It's provided by accredited social housing institutions, and I'll go into the definition of that into the bill a bit more, or in accredited social housing projects. And we've made that distinction specifically to allow for your non-profit sector as well as your for-profit sector to participate in social housing. And then it is provided in designated restructuring zones at the end of the day. Just to highlight one or two more points on social housing, the delivery agents for social housing, the people who are going to build, own, and manage the properties of social housing, are either non-profit companies, municipal-owned entities, or housing cooperatives. And all of those three are then referred to as social housing institutions. For-profit companies are also allowed to participate, as well as public-private partnerships can participate, but they're not specifically called social housing institutions. And again, this is reflected in the bill, where the bill is largely about managing the social housing institutions, but it also has made provision for managing for-profit companies and public and private companies. The next slide on page 7 at the bottom, I wanted to illustrate, because I found in the bill people tend to look for these other instruments. The policy introduces three sets of instruments, and you're only going to find the legislative instruments in the bill itself, but that doesn't mean the other instruments are not there. The other instruments are financial instruments and capacity building instruments, and both are provided for in the policy and are already up and there and in place, and they don't necessarily need the legislation at this point. But definitely for the policy to be fully functional, the legislative and regulatory instruments are required, which is the framework legislation, the bill itself, the Social Housing Regulatory Authority, which is introduced in the bill, and then the defined sector roles and role players. It needs to be defined in the legislation. It's not enough to have it defined in policy. So the bill deals with those elements, who the role players are, the regulator, and setting the scene for social housing. The policy and the guidelines deal with the financial instruments, which is what is called a restructuring capital grant, capacity building grants, tax incentives, and risk mitigation measures. And it also deals with capacity building instruments, which are around how to implement projects, how to make them effective, how to get the staff running, how to facilitate the sector, and all focused on running viable projects at the end of the day. All of those instruments are there, but you won't find them in the bill because they're in the actual policy and the guidelines to the bill. Then to get to the bill itself, the bill is aiming to regulate the social housing industry as a whole, and the social housing industry being this industry that is to intervene in the private rental housing market. It is also there to ensure affordable rental housing for households who cannot access rental on the open market. It's got 5 chapters, each chapter dealing with a specific theme in the bill. Obviously, chapter 1, which is page 8, the second slide, deals with the key terminology, which are central to the bill. The social housing institutions are defined, and the definition there is exactly the same and drawing on the definition in the policy. It defines exactly who low and medium income households are. And in Department of Housing, low and medium income households, you're looking at 1,500 to 3,500 being your low income, and 3,500 to 7,500 being your medium income households at this stage. Indigent households are 1,500 to zero. And those households primarily sit in the community residential units program, not in this program at this point. The bill also defines restructuring zones as these demarcated zones where social housing will happen, where inequity in terms of social, economic, and other elements are existing. The chapter 1 also sets out various principles which are specifically applicable to social housing. And in this case, social housing is about densifying. It is about people living together, closer together. It is about specific rental housing arrangements that exist. So they capture the principles of the Housing Act, but they do not duplicate those principles. They merely focus on the principles that are applicable to social housing, therefore supplementing and adding to what the principles in the Housing Act itself. In terms of Chapter 1, some typical terms that cause ambiguity, you'll find there's reference to approved projects and there's reference to accredited projects. Approved projects are in the process flow as the projects go through the various spheres of government for approval. So provinces would typically put forward approved projects to the regulator, whereas accredited projects are projects that are then fully approved and are typically run by the private sector. So there is a little bit of a distinction. Approved projects are when the projects are in the process to flow through the spheres of government. Accredited projects are when they come out of the process and they've gone through all spheres of government and everyone is happy with those projects and they meet all the criteria of the program. Low and medium income groups, I've already mentioned the definition of those income groups at this point in time. Quite critically, a lease agreement, you will find that rent to buy is not part of the social housing program. There is still the institutional housing subsidy that can deal with rent to buy, but the social housing program and the community residential units program do not allow for rent to buy. They are purely rental through a leasehold. So we define the leasehold quite specifically in this agreement to make sure that it's not an installment sale or rent to buy agreement, but a lease agreement. It could be month to month, it could be no specific dates added to it, but typically a lease agreement in this arrangement for social housing. Rent to buy, as I said, is possible through the institutional subsidy, but not in the social housing program. We've learned at this point that tenants tend to be confused in rent to buy on when they are a tenant and when they are an owner. And it makes the management of those properties particularly challenging, because one day a tenant will be a tenant and the next day he'll decide he's now the owner, and it's extremely difficult and it's quite a challenge to manage. A lot of capacity building required. So we've decided to scale up and mainstream the programs. It is better to focus it on leasehold rental upfront so that there is no confusion, because a tenant knows what to do when he's a tenant. There is no confusion about the role of a tenant necessarily. Chapter 2 deals with the roles and responsibilities of the various spheres of government. National's role is defined, province, local, and you'll see the role of the NHSC is also defined. Essentially, National's role is about creating and upholding a sustainable social housing environment. Provincial's role is about administering the social housing program, which is typically the role they are currently playing when they deal with a housing program. And local's role is about facilitating social housing in their area of jurisdiction. We've tried to, in defining the roles, to keep the roles to the typical roles of the three spheres of government as far as possible, and not to add on any additional roles which would require additional capacity and skills. So we've tried to keep it to the skill set and the capacity that the three spheres of government have. In terms of including the NHSC in the Chapter 2, NHSC has an added role here on improving access to loan funding, especially because we're trying to access and mobilize the private sector funders to fund social housing at the end of the day. Hence, the NHSC is included in here. Chairperson, you'll notice there is no role defined for the Social Housing Foundation. Essentially, the Social Housing Foundation will close once the regulator opens. So there will be a phase in and phase out of the Social Housing Foundation as the regulator is established. And some of my further slides will deal with that. So there is no role defined for the Social Housing Foundation in the legislation. I've shown you on page 10 at the top, and I'm not going to stay too long on it, but just to show you how we came to the various roles. We basically said for social housing there is a delivery process and there's a regulatory process. And we wanted to make sure that the role players in the regulatory process do not interfere with the delivery process. So they shouldn't feature on both levels. So we said we defined the players in the delivery process. There are players who provide leadership, some who provide delivery, some who fund, some who regulate, and some who facilitate. And underneath that delivery process, we then indicated the regulatory process, who would regulate those players for those roles. So in that way, we've made sure that if the department is regulating on leadership, then the department is not also involved in delivery, for example, because it can't regulate and deliver. So the regulator is there to monitor and accredit projects and oversee delivery, but the provinces, the local authorities and the institutions are the ones who do the delivery and make the program happen. So the regulator oversees those processes. And this is just the matrix we've used to make sure we don't confuse those delivery and regulatory roles and processes. It comes from the policy itself where that is captured. Chapter 3 deals with the establishment of the Social Housing Regulatory Authority. You will see the council is defined, the CEO, the corporate services manager, and other staff as necessary in the regulator. The regulator is quite key because we've had about 6 or 7 years of social housing through the institutional subsidy program. And we've realized through that experience that we're typically dealing with separate companies or entities, usually non-profits. And if they change direction or do something which was not the original intention of the program, we are not able to intervene or make any intervention to change that direction. So as a result, the project is affected. So the regulator will give us that power and authority to make sure that the the delivery agents delivering social housing are delivering it to the target market and with the objectives that we want. There is different institutional forms that are required by PFMA. I've just on the top of page 11 outlined to you how we came to the regulated form. At the end of the day, that it's a regulatory public entity that we're establishing in terms of PFMA, and that is captured in the in the bill itself. Chapter 3 further defines the powers and functions, which is about regulating the social housing sector, accrediting social housing institutions, advising the minister on social housing, administering and disbursing capital and institutional grants, compliance monitoring, and having the power to intervene in the management of social housing institutions. Quite critical powers that currently in the environment that we have now, we are not able to do unless we follow long and complicated legal processes. This makes it much easier to protect government resources as well as private sector resources that have been invested in projects and to ensure that the target market is served that needs to serve. I reflect a bit on the intervention powers. The regulator will be able to instruct an SHI to take remedial action as proposed by the regulator, and in cases where that SHI doesn't follow those remedial actions, the regulator will be able to order a forensic audit, suspend members of the board of a social housing institution, and apply to the High Court to place that institution under administration, which are quite strong powers that the regulator would have at the end of the day. I indicated on page 12 at the bottom that with the phasing in of the regulator, typically called the SHRA, the SHS will be phased out and closed. Basically, there's three stages to this process. There's a preparation phase, which kicks in the moment the bill is turned into an act. We can start with the preparation phase activities, and I detail in the diagram exactly what are those preparation phase activities. There is an establishment phase set of activities, and again, I detail those activities, and then there's an operational phase. Typically, to phase out the SHF and phase in the SHRA, one would be looking at about a year, which is the preparation and establishment phases, which would we hope if the bill is passed in this financial year, we could kickstart, and by next year that would be concluded, and we would see from 2009 the operational phase of the regulator kicking in. And it's actually performing both its regulatory and program oversight functions. Chapter 4 deals with the social housing institutions. It's about accrediting them and their functioning. And basically we're saying once this bill comes into play, only accredited social housing institutions can participate in the program and access government grants and government funding. So no other players outside or who are not accredited would be able to access government funding to provide rental housing. Criteria provided within which the social housing institutions must operate, which includes the approval of their corporate governance by the regulator. We've often found that with these social housing institutions, their boards are very weak, and therefore the rest of the organization suffers because of a weak board, bad decision making, and it just cascades down into the project. And ultimately, we want to protect the project, so we need to see who are being appointed to the boards of the institutions and make sure that it's a strong company that is accessing government funding. Chapter 5 provides provisions for the Minister of Housing to either create a program to fund, to create a national social housing program and provide the funding for it, and to make regulations to the Act. And on page 14, I give you the sense of the regulations which will be coming into play. On the one hand, there will be a code of conduct, which relates to the SHRA. There will be investment criteria, and there will be qualifying criteria. So which projects are we going to invest in, and what are the qualifying criteria to be a social housing institution? There will be regulations for the SHRA and other delivery agents. There will be regulations to monitor the relationship between the SHRA and the provinces, between the SHRA and the NHSC, as well as administrative matters of the SHRA would have to be put into regulations as well. So those are the sets of regulations that are proposed at this point that would have to follow the bill to make it fully operational and functional as a bill. So in conclusion on the social housing bill, and I hope I haven't overloaded with detail and acronyms and statements, but you're welcome to ask me many questions. I'm open to that. Chapter 1, Terminology and Principles. Chapter 2, Roles and Responsibilities. Chapter 3, SHRA Establishment. And SHRA, on a lighter note, is no relation to SHREC. So SHRA is on its own, the Social Housing Regulatory Authority. Chapter 4 is about the social housing institution. And Chapter 5, the program and the regulations itself. Thank you, Chair. I'm open to questions. I should add one more point around the urgency of the bill. The Minister has often indicated this bill is quite critical going forward if we want to scale up and make rental housing accessible for the poor. But we're also looking at this bill giving stability, clarity and direction in the rental housing sector where there hasn't really been before, to facilitate the growth of the rental housing sector, and also to, at the opportune moment, harness the bigger institutions and the private sector to come and participate in the housing delivery process, and more specifically the rental housing delivery process. So it's quite key for us to have this protection in place to bring the private sector in, and then to entice and provide comfort for funders, both locally and internationally, for this sector, because they've currently been operating in an environment where they've largely been unprotected at the end of the day. Chair, I have two more bits of information. I have a listing of the institutions who have previously submitted comments on this bill, which I can make available to your team. Institutions are primarily the metros. We've had some banks making submissions. There were one or two provinces, the Banking Association, DCLG, the National Association of Social Housing Organizations, a range of players. I've got the listing of who submitted. I've also got the submissions if you would like to see them. In summary, from the submissions on the bill, and this would probably be, I suspect, what the committee would mostly debate, among other things, but typically the issues that have come up for debate and for consideration are the restructuring zones element, the how municipal entities fit into this process and will be managed in the process, the separation of powers between government and the regulator come up quite a bit for debate. Rent to buy versus only going the leasehold route comes up for debate. And then there's quite a bit of debate on the SHRA powers and functions and where the SHF will fit in that phasing out. Those have been the kind of main issues that have come up in the submissions for debate and consideration. And Chair, from the SHF side, Mr. Mohorlo can just give you insight into some of the issues between the process of getting to the NCOP, what kind of changes and issues have emerged prior to coming to this committee, so that you can also get some insight into those issues. It would not be too long.
Check page 14. It says Social Housing Bill 29 of 1997.
Thanks, and good morning. The process really has been, we had public comments and submissions. The list is there. But there was also a very intensive session that we had with the Portfolio Committee on Housing. And really what came out there was to clean out the definitions and the terminology in the bill, just to make sure that it's consistent with other policies that we have in the country. And I think those have been incorporated in the draft that we now have before you. There was an issue around how the regulatory authority council would be appointed by the minister, and that was clarified, that was dealt with. Another major issue that came up was accountability, because the committee felt that if you're going to use public funds to attract the private sector, how do you then hold the private sector accountable to that? That was debated extensively, but finally resolved in a manner that, in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, they would still be eligible to account having received funds from government. And the issue around the Social Housing Foundation, the phasing in and the phasing out of the Social Housing Foundation with the regulatory authority was raised, and that was also left to the department to work out. And I think the department has worked out a process to deal with that. Opposed to that, what has happened is that we have what we call interim social housing program, which is a pilot program in the absence of a regulatory authority, and that is being held and being driven by the Social Housing Foundation at the moment. We have already awarded grants to projects in KwaZulu-Natal and where's the other one? Here in the Western Cape. And we have submitted a business plan which is approved by the Department of Housing around further programs for 2 years, 2008 and 2009. And that program is quite important in the sense that it will start to also set the tone as to how the SHRA will deal with social housing in the future. I think those would just be my highlights. Thanks.
Okay,
now,
thank you very much for the presentation. I think it would only be fair to allow them members to engage with the presentation on the social housing bill. If there are any questions for clarity, it would be good that let's first deal with questions for clarity, because obviously there might be a lot of engagement that we would expect to come out of this. Let's first deal with questions for clarity, and then the second round can then begin to engage with the actual substantive issues that you might have picked up setting up or coming out of the game. Honorable Van Rooyen and then Lizzie.
Thank you, Chairperson. Question for clarification. I notice on the list of people that were consulted, that was given, no mention was made of the Department of Land Affairs. And I think this impacts on the Department of Land Affairs. Is there a specific reason why they were not consulted? If you can just elaborate on that, because I think they got a very important role to play. So, yeah. Then she mentioned also the regulations and the things will come later. But will that regulation go through a public process? And how is it going to be done so that people can get involved in it? Then the third one, nowhere in this presentation is there any reference to the financial impact. Can we have some sort of indication of what is the financial impact over the next MTF period? Because I read somewhere that there is money available for it. And then SHF, I'm not so sure, will that be incorporated now into the regulator, or are they just going to disappear from the face of the earth? Because there is resources there. And the last one, which is very, very strange to me, there's no mention of rural development here. It's only metros and cities. Can I just advise us on that? Thank you, Jefferson.
While Pavan Zizi comes in, maybe that's one of the financial implications. You might have specific issues you would want to raise. If you go to the memorandum on the object, there is a section there on financial implications over the next financial cycle. Probably you can pick up on that from me.
Thank you, Chairperson. Though Chairperson is a bit ambiguous when you say clarity and then question, because they contest both each other. But nonetheless, I would probably have one clarity which I would like to indicate that others would just become as a question. Though it is speaking clarity when you ask a question. the only challenge that I wanted to speak here is that it becomes very ambiguous on page 4 on proposed rental strategy. It speaks of correcting the historical problem. But if you look at the first sentence, it says the public housing and hostels. Those are the two separate things. But if you read it further, it says coherent framework for public housing and hostels indigenous. Now, when you talk of hostel indigenous, hostels just stop rental housing. Now, indigenous, you may find them everywhere in the township. Now, how do we identify hostel indigenous in this connotation? Because they're not indigenous to me. They can afford paying rent. And in an indigenous is where you seek to know the background of the person, where the government can subsidize that person, if they cannot be cared.
Are there any questions for clarity? Honorable.
Thanks, Chair. The acting chief director made reference right in the beginning of her presentation to a property boom. And I'm very confused about that because it's common cause that the property market's in a very bad way. In fact, if you speak to the CEOs of the major estate agencies in South Africa today, they'll tell you there's a state of panic. So there's massive offloading of second houses, whether they be for holiday or investment purposes. And many, many people overseas who are intending to come back have now told them to cancel, particularly in the light of the power failures. So I'm not exactly sure why this bill is premised on the problems caused by a property boom, when actually what we have is a developing and very rapidly escalating housing glut. So perhaps you could just clarify that.
Chairperson, maybe I'm very slow in understanding. Maybe the lady was too fast in my mind, I'm not sure. But if I have to go and brief the province, for now I'll be having nothing to brief about. And that's why I say maybe I'm different from other people. I'm a slow person to catch. If you know a subject and you just give it to people who are not having the background, I think you must really make them understand what do we have now and why we are doing it. It must dawn very clear to my mind. So that, I don't know, maybe I'm asking an impossible question here. But I have to go to a province and play the province. And as I'm saying, the presenter was really too fast for me. I don't know how clear the presenter was. He knows what he's talking about. But he's giving it to somebody who does not have the background necessarily. Therefore, usually you will try to go an extra mile to make your subject much more understood. There should be a way. I don't know. I'm just thinking aloud. But I want to be honest to myself. I want to be honest to myself and so that I'm in a position really to grasp what's been said here. How, I don't know. This is the only briefing before we go to the provinces. And my other question is on the implications for the provinces. This deal implications for the provinces, if that could be outlined. Thank you, Chair. I hope I am not difficult.
No, I don't think you are difficult, sir. I think we are already getting ourselves to engage. That is exactly what I was trying to say about this deal with start is 60 and then once we are there, we'll tell them that we'll then come back. A very important issue that the Reverend is raising, and just as I build up to that, Mr. Clifton, probably you might be able to respond to it as well. You know, when I went through the bill last night, I found something very interesting in your memorandum on the options, your parliamentary procedure. There is an acknowledgement of the state law's advice or opinion for the bill to be dealt with in terms of Section 76 of the Constitution of the Republic. But when I listen to Mr. Mwono, it is quite clear that you introduced the bill in the National Assembly. Nothing wrong with that. But in the presentation, Mrs. Clifton made mention of the fact that around the urgency of the bill. Why did you find it to introduce it in the NA instead of the NCOP, which still has to go back to provinces and do all those things in terms of consultations, public hearings, and all that, and still know the urgency of the bill? If that can also be just raised in the charity. Thank you.
Chairperson, to add on that, this morning in the programming, it was raised that there are more bills coming. We should now hurry up with whatever we have in the backlog. It seems as if when it's dealt in the NA, there's no agency. There's no need to frustrate. But when it comes to us now, if it's a 76, even 76 bills, then there's an agency to frustrate it and do everything now. Probably it is not the platform for the department, but I think the agency for the department as well, because these bills are time framed in each session. Time frame that side, time frame this side. But without it, it will become different as you raise it.
Chairperson, I must agree with the Reverend, because this presentation had one hell of a speech. And luckily I had the privilege of reading these things before and look at the internet. But even if you look at the slides, they are so small, some of them, you can't read it. And I don't think that's fair. And for me to go make a presentation to the provinces on this thing is going to be very, very, very difficult. See, obviously knows the subject, but this is the first time that we are getting confronted with this thing, and it went to I couldn't even make notes so fast as it was going through. If I haven't read it before, I wouldn't have known what is going on. So I don't know if some of the other members also, because I was going to stop her at one stage and say, please, just slow down. We also want to make notes, so I don't know what we're going to do about it. But they briefed the portfolio committee twice on this thing. We get one briefing and then we have to go and brief the provinces. I don't think it is fair.
Okay, Mrs.
Carter.
Okay. We are already engaged. I'm getting a sense that we are engaging. Can you allow her? It's not about engaging.
Okay. Can we change this ask the description possibly to make her notes available to us? These are the slides. She can have a note. Then we can read them at our own pace, taking all the information. I couldn't keep up either, actually. And I know something about this market. And I couldn't keep up. And if we had that, that would solve the problem. And then we're all in a better position to go brief our provinces. Through you, Chair, can I request that she makes that available to us?
Let's take it as a comment. Are you making a request?
Something that I need to establish. We're getting a briefing today, and according to the program, there's another briefing that is supposed to come back on the 13th of February, the program that we got today. It's here, Jefferson. I'm taking from this document.
Okay. That's a parliamentary process. We will have to engage. We'll definitely have to give attention to that. Because, like I requested earlier when I opened the meeting, I made a remark to the effect that probably at the end, maybe as a committee, we just need 5 minutes of our time just to look at the program. Because now that's a totally different program, which is way off what we used to come up to what we have now here as a proposal. So let's first deal with the responses, and then if there are issues that we think need to be picked up for further engagement, we can then do that. And then towards the end of our meeting, outline then the process that we're going to follow from here for.
Thank you, Chair. Apologies if I went too far. I would have appreciated this if you slow me down, because sometimes I don't realize when I'm going too far. So I apologize for that, and I'll try and go a bit slower, because I do realize this bill is very dense. There's a lot of information in it. It's a new field and a new subject. And what I tried to do in my presentation is first to give you the rental housing sector context, which usually is the first point, and then to move from there to the social housing policy document, which I can definitely make available, and has a lot more information which will explain a lot of the things that are in the bill and why the bill is the way it is, and then to position the bill from there before actually going into the details of the bill. Because I found when briefing on the bill alone, then it is even more abstract without those other pieces of information. But again, the information on the rental housing sector and on the social housing policy can definitely be made available, and that will complement what you will be reading in the bill most definitely. Some of the easier and upfront questions, maybe not too easy, but I'm hoping I can answer them before the other heavy questions. On the list of people consulted with regards to the Department of Land Affairs, currently land in housing and access to land in housing is a cross-cutting issue. It's not specific just to rental housing, but it affects all other forms of housing. So the department is engaging with land affairs around accessing land for all forms of housing at this point in time, because it's a dire need. Specifically, why land affairs wasn't consulted on this bill per se, I don't have a definite answer at this point, but I know there is discussions between the departments on land for housing as a totality, which includes rental land and ownership land, if that is the issue you were noting in the bill as the urgent issue that needs to be considered out of the bill. I'm not sure if that is there. With regards to the regulation, yes, most definitely it will go through a public process. It's quite important for all of the role players to understand the regulations in order to participate in the program. So a public process will be held for the publishing of the regulation. It indicates in the bill itself that it will be gazetted for public comment, but even in the development of the regulations, there is a public process that happens with that. So we're not going to be developing regulations without the sector being involved in those regulations. The financial impact of the bill, the memorandum reflects the MTEF allocations with regards to the social housing program and the SHRA. Also noting, which the bill doesn't have specifically, is that currently the SHF has a budget allocation in the MTEF as well that would also carry to the SHRA. So apart from the amount expected there would be the SHS budget that would carry to that process. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, it's about 20 million per annum, 18 to 20 per annum over the 3-year period. That would also go onto the program. With regards to the SHS will be incorporated. The current program that they are running is one of the core programs of the SHRA, so that would be incorporated into the SHRA. What is not there and hasn't been developed and would need to be developed for the SHRA is the regulatory program. So how to run and fund the institutions, that part of the program is operating, but how to regulate, accredit, and manage these institutions, that has to be developed, and that will be the new niche almost and core focus of the SHRA, as well as the function that the SHF is currently performing. And hence, in the slide, I indicated at a point where there is some detail on the phasing in and the phase out of the SHU entity and the different activities that will be happening to phase them in and phase them out. Again, there is a specific business plan that has been through this National Treasury public entities process and the public service public entities process prior to the bill coming here for the SHRA, detailing how the SHRA will function, what it's going to cost, how it will look, all of those different elements are captured in that business plan. And the SHH phasing out basically is related to that process, which the department will be going through. The bill doesn't specifically mention rural development. It doesn't specifically mention urban development, although, yes, the policy is biased towards urban areas. The bill and the implementation of rental housing will largely happen in urban areas, but the bill is not written in a manner that it excludes rural areas at this point in time. So if there is a restructuring zone in a rural area, it would be possible to do social housing in that area. At the moment, because of the way that the cities are growing, the in-migration, the rental housing demand, the program will primarily start its focus in the urban and metro areas. But that's in the implementation of the program. But the bill doesn't specifically say urban only or rural only. It doesn't make that distinction. So the bill allows that it could be in any area. But because of the urgency and the need, the program is focusing on urban and metro areas to start with. The ambiguities of hostels and the indigents, again up front, and I probably went very fast here, there are two programs in housing that deal with rental housing specifically. The one is the social housing program, and social housing at this point in time targets your lower and middle income groups, which are from 1,500 rand a month all the way to 7,500. It's not typically that social housing will be done in hostels at this point in time. The community residential units program, however, will be done in hostels and in public stock that is owned by government. Typically, when one goes into the hostels and looks at the hostel redevelopment, you have people with an income, but they're usually lower income than the people who are staying in the public flats. So we typically, in Department of Housing, when we refer to indigent groups, they are people who earn incomes below 1,500 rand a month, all the way down to zero or no income. And hence the CRU program makes provision for those groups. And typically your hostel residents in many cases fall in your below 1,500 rand a month income category. And the CRU program would start to redevelop that hostel, look at affordable rentals that partly can accommodate, almost fully depending on the amount of involvement of the local authority, can accommodate your indigent groups as well as your lower income groups. So we don't want to redevelop a hostel, and in many cases hostels are well located in your urban areas, and then have middle income groups coming and staying in that redeveloped hostel. We want to redevelop it and keep it for lower and lower income groups, subsidized groups, to make sure they have access to housing as well and rental accommodation. So that's what CRU is trying to do. I'm not sure if that fully answers your question.
That would mean that
in the hostels you would get indigents as well. It's not that we're saying the hostel is indigent, but when you interrogate the people living in the hostel, you would get mostly those residents would be indigent in housing terminology.
The argument they go on, but I think that's a question we have when the engaging questions will come in the back.
The property boom. Yes, I agree with you. We're at a bit of a property slump at the moment. There is a state of panic, but it doesn't help the rental housing market. So we've had a boom. We're at a slump. I think if I listen to people, they're predicting another boom towards the end of the year. So with every slump, it booms again. Now, rental housing has been adversely affected by the boom, and it's adversely affected by the slump. Because with the boom, the landlords could charge whatever they want for rental properties, and people were renting it. With the slump, more people want to rent because they now have to sell their houses they can't afford. But the rentals are so high at this point that they can't find anywhere affordable to rent. So both the boom and the slump affects the rental housing market for the tenant who's looking for that rental opportunity. in both cases, the market is at a point where if the rentals are so high and the cost of managing rental properties, purchasing rental properties, redeveloping rental properties is extremely high. So the rentals as a result are very high. So if you access it, you can only really get at a very high level those rentals. For the landlord, yes, there's a lot of properties coming on the market now that you can get at a bargain. You buy it up and you can make it available as rental accommodation. You buy it at a bargain, you charge those higher rentals, so as a landlord, you're enjoying the slums. But still, there is no access for your lower income group to access those rental opportunities. So both the boom and the slump are not helping the rental housing market. Hence, I say the rental housing market at this point is a dysfunctional market because it's benefiting your people with larger incomes and higher incomes. And it's not allowing access for people on lower incomes, especially in good locations where the people are working and where the opportunities are. So I hope that gives a bit of clarity. If the market booms again, it's going to be even worse for rentals because, again, we get the rentals going higher, more exclusion, less access for your lower income groups at the end of the day. The implications of this bill for the provinces, correctly, that's the key question. But when I was preparing for this briefing, I thought, should I include a much larger emphasis on provinces in the process? But I thought, let me introduce the bill, and then you can interrogate and ask me questions on the role of the provinces, because they're quite key. On the one hand, the local authorities are key, but as you're aware, the provinces look over a number of local authorities and have influence over a number of local authorities. Firstly, the provinces, through their growth and development strategies, are able to influence what happens in an area in a province. They can influence where strategic interventions can happen. So the province plays a role in determining where social housing is strategically going to be located. And it could be in your metro or your urban areas or even your rural areas. The province has the role to decide. In terms of its growth and development strategy, strategically, if we put social rental housing in these areas, we're going to change the markets in those areas. The local authority can only look at its area of jurisdiction, and it can only consult and identify areas in its own area of jurisdiction. But the province looks provincial-wide and can identify those areas where strategic intervention of social housing and restructuring would be key. And they have that role defined in the bill. Quite critically, the provinces would disperse and manage this funding. The grant funding is combined with private sector funding, so significantly larger than your other housing programs, which is an added responsibility on the provinces. Because it's not just a government grant, the grant will require the capacity in the provinces to understand what would a private sector funder fund. Would the private sector fund this rental housing property? So the capacity and understanding for rental housing needs to be built into the provinces, and they need to begin to appreciate and understand rental housing and accommodate it in their structure and in managing the rental property, so that they know that the projects that they fund that are called social housing projects will ultimately be viable and sustainable. When one talks about rental housing, it's not just about building the project. Once the project is built, you've got tenants. They rent on an ongoing basis, and so there are a lot of property management issues. And the province would play a role in making sure if there are any conflicts or issues there, they would play a role in that. So quite critically, planning up front is a key role for the provinces. Administering and disbursing and accounting for the funding, key role for the provinces. Supplementing and ensuring the local authorities have the capacity to manage and oversee this program, critical role for the provinces to play at the end of the day. Making sure that the role players perform the function they're supposed to perform, that being the municipality, the delivery agents, and other role players. That is a role for the provinces at the end of the day. And then making sure that the project from beginning to end is managed and properly implementing is a typical and current role of the provinces. And they would have to do that for, in this case, a medium density or higher density development, which is a new kind of development for the provinces, as opposed to the RDT units, the BNG units, if you like, that they've been doing up to date. So this is medium density, higher density development that they would have to oversee from beginning to end. Key role to ensure that those projects are properly implemented. as I said before, I went quite fast, so please slow me down if I go too fast, because I can give you lots of information, but let me give it to you in the right pauses so that you can also be with me in the process. And that's also why I brought DSHS with to fill in where I am lacking. I've given the implications on the provinces. I can provide the social housing policy, which will contextualize a lot more of the things, as well as the SHRA business case, which will explain the regulator in more detail. The actual process, I'm not a fully on the legal process for the passing of the bill, but I know in both the parliamentary committee and in this committee, the urgency was stressed in both cases of why the bill is necessary to create stability, give focus and direction to the social rental housing sector, so that we're not worrying about policy and legislation, which we've been doing for the last 2 or 3 years. It's taken to almost get to this point. But we can focus on implementing rental, scaling up rental, and directing and aligning all the players to do what they need to do in terms of implementing rental housing. So then in both committees, there was an urgency reflected. It's not only that we're giving an urgency to this committee to put that up front. The process that was followed there, I was advised by the departmental legal route. I wouldn't be able to comment on the process myself at this point. I would have to refer back to legal on why the process was the way the process was. Unfortunately, I can't comment on that. So, Chair, I can take some more questions of substance and or further clarity on what I have provided.
Okay.
Chair.
Thank you. Firstly, just to latch on to the last, second last input from the Acting Chief Director, this explanation that you gave on the provinces and the importance of them in the whole system, is that captured in the bill, or is it somewhere else? It's in the bill.
That's the policy.
Is that also in the bill?
Okay.
The other question that I need to get clarity on is that we've just gone through this long process of introducing the rental housing bill, or was it amendments to it? I can't remember. It was amendments.
Yeah.
It was amendments. But in that you have also the body, I forget the name now, that KwaZulu-Natal was unhappy about. What did they call it? Please help me. The tribunals, yeah. Now, you have the tribunals. Now, here you have the rental housing, research, what do you call this body?
SHRA.
Now, isn't there an overlapping of authority between those two bodies? If I'm a tenant, I couldn't care two hoots whether it's funded through this social housing bill, or whether it's a private landlord. And so maybe, you know, where does the tenant that we're trying to protect and not just protect, but empower to have housing, who is the tenant to refer to in the first place? Because if the members of parliament tell you that we're a bit confused, what about the poor guy who's renting? He knows nothing about all these homes. So please, if you could just clarify that for me. I'm sure it's something that's going to come up.
Chairperson, if I may add my voice on the previous request or suggestion. The presentation, say, if we can take it right from now and then go to the process, is not reader friendly. Probably the dilemma we have, we talk of social housing, rental housing. Now, one tries to distinguish between the two. Probably both of them, there's exchange of objects. It's not gratis. Now, probably if whatever notes we may have could delve more in depth of social housing, so that when you brief the problem, you know what you're talking about. We are not professors where we could probably link other things or advocate in the High Court. If we could probably give a note that would deal a straight subject, if I may put it that way.
Now, going to questions which we said that will be coming through the back window. Chair, on page 6, social housing policy. Now, among other things that which boggles my mind, it's the second bulletin. Focus on involvement of the private sector, allowing for a maximum cross subsidization from higher through middle income to support lower income. You know, at a glance, if one looks at that, you immediately say, oh, they will rob Peter to pay Paul. How do you determine that now this one must pay higher in order to subsidize that one? And you cannot really go to the province or to a lay person and explain that is that now there will be those who will be paying high rent and in the same premises so as to subsidize you. Then people will really start kicking what's in the rise and argument. But if we can get a clarity, how do you determine that? I can see it, foresee a problem. The other one on the next page, I fully agree on the one thing on the delivery agent for social housing. And that is straight cap checking. But now, the other two, for profit company and public private partnership, what are they called? Who are those? Let me be a devil's advocate. Do we talk about banks where you get bonds and then many... where do they fall in this social housing instrument? If I can get the credit of those two, the for-profit and another. The other one is on page 9. I don't know... Where are we now actually going to? When we talk about this, I know what this is to the thought. If one looks it back in the age where we had a 99-year lease, where if your father dies, whoever takes over does not carry on and go forward to the 99-year lease. You start from scratch. Now, these leases I fully understand that you can leave a place. Now, how does it actually now affect us social housing as well as the rental housing? If I rent a house, I must leave. In the social housing, first is the same. What is the difference between the two? Why are we talking of low and medium income groups in this context?
Probably the last one, sir. And they are lucky.
It's on page 30. It says only accredited social housing institutions may participate in the national housing program and associate grants. Social housing, whatever way. Now, the problem I have. The people who will be in those categories are the people who have everything, who had everything in the past. Those who were marginalized will never reach that bracket. I don't know what criteria we're going to use. I will open another prayer who will get into those, what's the name, who will be accredited because they've got money. The PEE can even forget getting that. If perhaps you can get the criteria, how are we going to use so that those who are marginalized could also come into the same proximity and be able to participate? Thank you, sir.
I must just confess to this meeting that one problem that probably might be afraid of in terms of, I think it is page 6, relates to the question that he asked me now the other day around what is the relationship between socialism and communism. And I can understand where he's coming from, cross-subsidization, because it's not about from each according to ability to eat, according to need. Nowhere.
Thank you, Chair.
Maybe I will move from a premise of ignorance, but I will not add to that. So it's not a fault of this collective. Me not having been informed prior to on certain areas. But I think we are venturing into an area which is very important, but a bit sophisticated and challenging. I will speak from experience of my own thoughts. I think some of the members around here and other people do understand the challenges that the Eastern Cape is facing. Currently, we're just building houses for the poor. Huge challenges. And we come with this very complex and very important process of delivery of housing, because of the current challenges that we have of demand and accessibility. Other questions have been asked. I won't venture into that. You see, we talk of managing not only the process, but when social housing is there, That becomes more of a challenge in managing that. These issues of cross-subsidization, it's managing, as she was saying, managing the management agent. I think it's very critical. Now the question is the capacity. It's not a question for this forum. I'm just asking myself, you know, whether the capacity issues have been discussed elsewhere. But one question I want to ask is, what is the relationship going to be between the current developmental processes that we have engaged into regarding hostels, where there is a mixture of course, whose majority is the indigent, and those that can afford the rent? Are we going to evict them, or are we going to encourage them to go elsewhere and avail that? Has that been discussed as a challenge? What is going to be the situation in the current private sector arrangement of existing social housing in terms of the private sector that they have been running for a number of years? I know the other one is to do with partnerships and so on. Are we going to encourage partnerships? Or we're just going to leave them to run and escalate rental, etc., etc.? Those are my two questions. Thank you, sir. Follow up to that?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chapter 2. When I was reading bill myself, I was thinking that in a way I do understand what is in here, but now I'm a bit confused. Like I don't know whether this bill is about the rental or it's about what is this social housing. I wanted to link this thing with what is it that we're having here that all the provinces did contribute in N2 Gateway. And then if it was about this social housing, or is it now that I'm looking at, initially we had that, and we had that every province was to contribute to the N2 Gateway. I wanted you to link this social housing with that. I wanted to know what is it. But when I was reading in your memorandum in the bill, in 2.4, where we are saying social housing institution. I'm also coming from the problematic province, which you know as a department, you even take our money that we didn't use, we use. He's correcting what he said, that this question of capacity, I don't know, you are coming to take the budget that you have given us. I didn't know, when did you monitor those budgets that they must be used, even before you go and take it, but I'm not querying that. When we were in this province, for instance, in the Eastern Cape, we were hearing this problem of accredited. So can you say more about this 2.4 social housing institution that chapter 4 makes provision for the accreditation of function of social housing institution? Because we did get that one other problem that is provinces, they are not functioning well, is this problem of accreditation. So if it was already there, but how are we going to work with this? And then also I was worried when you were giving us a briefing saying that a person consulted. I've heard you saying that about 2 or 3 provinces. I'm just worried whether my province is it among those provinces, just because really, as we are sitting here, when we are going down to our provinces, we'll be getting really that the department, they are thinking that we've come here to unpack or to lecture them as if you were not consulted with each department of 9 provinces. So I don't have any problem, just because ours is to brief them about the amendment. But immediately that is a consultation, it's not saying that 9 departments of provinces were consulted. I'm having a problem. I want to be clear on the consultation. But really, I wanted to check the relationship between N2 Gateway and with this social housing bill, because we're talking about social housing bill, and then in between I'm hearing talking about the rental. I know that these are rental things which are built here on the N2 Gateway. So I want to get what is it, and now I'm coming back to the briefing notes. We are always getting slides when we are having briefings, but the notes are so important, just because whilst you were speaking, if you were speaking to your notes, not to your slides, it was going to be okay. Maybe before this day, which is this day, Matlanya? Now? The day of going to our provinces for briefing, 14th and 15th, would love that in the office of our chairperson, you must get those prepared notes. Well, maybe we must not make an issue, but if we can get it as from today or tomorrow, in order that you must familiarize with our notes, with your presentation, with the slides, in order that we are saying that we are a bit confused, but it's a very important piece of legislation that we must put together the notes of our gurus. But the question of Section 76, I'm not speaking for the minister. I'm worried about our officials here, just because they are taking what the politician is saying, the head of the department, the minister, and the minister advised by the legal advisors, law state advisors. We have been saying in this parliament since we came, in the rules committee of the parliament, and in the programming meetings of the NCOP, saying that Section 76, would love to see that they must be introduced first and foremost in the second house, just because this is the only house which is dealing with Section 75, this is bill. Now, we'll be in a dilemma, just because once you are away chairperson in another work of the parliament, we've been asked in the programming committee that the minister asked us that this bill is so urgent, but everybody of this parliament, when I'm saying parliament, I'm talking about NA and NCOP, consists of two houses to make a parliament, they know that we have got a cycle of 6 weeks. And now, if even then, if the provinces will be saying to us, we're not yet consulting the whole stakeholders, we have even got a right to come back saying that, you know, our province, just because Section 76, nothing else, it's our provinces that they must give us flesh and come with negotiating mandates. We are saying, once we know that your state law advisor advises our minister and you follow suit, starting in the NA and then ended in the NCOP, we'll be raising this again and again, but also you must think that we've said that. But it's not the first time that we're saying that. We've been telling our bosses, if they are our bosses and your bosses, we're pleading that Section 76 must start in this house in order that we must do justice. I've seen here saying that you didn't invite the, what you call, the traditional leaders, just because according to, it's the understanding of the law advisors, but somebody was asking about land. There are also land what belong to those traditional house traditional leaders in our rural areas. So sometimes we don't know these state advisors which are advising our ministers whether they know what they are doing. I'm just a rural a woman who doesn't know about the law, but I know the politics of my rural area. Immediately that you're talking about the land and the land and the houses that must be erected for the people, the poor, the poorest, you must consult these Amakosi. And immediately that I was reading, hearing that they felt that the traditional leaders, they were supposed not to be consulted. It's one another thing. If maybe this bill was started to us, we'll be saying that we are proposing stakeholders which must be consulted. So I'm saying that those things that are not happening just because the bill is not starting from us as Section 76.
Honorable Wati wanted to make a follow-up.
Yes, I was actually
going to follow up on what you said, right? By Babam Zizi here, but also touched on by Beauty. The question on page 13, which from Zizi raised, saying that, I'm not sure what his question there was, but it says, Chapter 4 provides accreditation and functioning of SHI, and only accredited social housing institutions may participate in the program. But on page 7, we're saying that delivery agents are non-profit companies, municipal-owned entities, housing cooperatives, for-profit companies, and public-private partnerships. Is there a difference between the agent and the accredited SHI? This is confusing me a bit.
Hello, Matanya.
Yeah, Chairperson, you can realize that I'm also a slow catcher. So I'm a little bit confused, but I tried going through the bill yesterday. Something that catched my eye was on page 7 of the bill. Starting from line 50, on the National Housing Finance Corporation. And I know most of the time the legal gurus will always talk about must, may, shall, and all those other things. Then, to my mind, I'm asking myself, it says subject to such directives as the minister may issue by notice in the government gazette, the National Housing Finance Corporation must, in respect of social housing. Then, A, it says must provide access to loan funding. So what comes to my mind is it the only institution that is supposed to be providing housing? Because C says facilitate or where possible, provide access to guarantees for loan funding from financial institutions. What I want to establish is that are the indigents allowed to have alternative funding that can they can choose? You know, they are they allowed to have to decide where to go for funding, or are they going to be forced to approach National Housing Finance Corporation? That's something that I want to understand. Who is going to be deciding on where they must go? Because if it says must, to me it means it's obligatory. They must go directly to the NHFC. I don't know whether I'm understanding it the way it's supposed to be. But the second issue that I want to raise is in connection with the regulations. Most of the time when, as members, we pass bills, we agree that there must be regulations. But you discover at the end, they've been passed and you're not part of it. So my request is to say that all the regulations that are going to go hand in hand with this bill, let us be part of them before they are approved. Because we have realized that some of them, after this, become very problematic for us to be able to monitor the implementation thereof. So, Chairperson, I think that those are the other things that I wanted to raise in addition to what other members have raised. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. So, firstly, on the question of the Department of Land Affairs and the consultation, I don't think I can accept the explanation that was given here that the department is talking to the Department of Land Affairs on broadly issues. This is a bill that impacts on the Department of Land Affairs and land issues. I would thought that it can't be that difficult to consult with them and show them this bill. Because every time a department comes to us, they say, but there is no consultation, they didn't know about these things. You know, other departments doesn't consult, and the one blames the other one. So I thought, you know, the explanation given here wasn't satisfactory. I think they still need to talk to Department of Land Affairs and consult them. Although the department on a certain level is talking to them in terms of the broad housing development, the IDPs and things like that. But this thing is a bill that impacts them. Next time you ask the Department of Land Affairs, what about this? I say, no, we were never consulted. We don't even know about it. So it's a simple thing that I think needs to be done. Then also on consultation, I don't know if I missed it, but was there any consultation with SALGA on this bill? Because it impacts on municipalities. And what was the outcome of that? If I can come to the bill itself. Now, going through the bill, I just picked up a couple of issues. Now, one of the issues that I picked up there seems to be some overlapping here. And what I want to know, where does the buck stop here? Because if you look at just the regulatory authority is supposed to promote and develop awareness, then the national government is also going to do that, promote
the development in clause 3.1e. The provincial government is also doing creating awareness, 4.1b. There is overlapping here. Where does the buck stop? Who's going to create the awareness and the development? The same with the, if you look at clause 11.1d, promote an enabling environment. But on natural departments also, that is a regulator must create an environment, promote an enabling environment. But the natural department must create and uphold an enabling environment. What is the difference between those? Are there no overlapping? The one must promote and the other one must create. What are they trying to tell us here? Then, what about the physically disabled? Yesterday we had a briefing by the Department of Tourism, and the physically disabled. Where do they feature in this thing? How are they going to be accommodated in this bill? Because nowhere does it talks about that. Then, 30. I don't know what is the definition of a non-profiting company. Who are these people? They're going into this industry, non-profit company. Who are these people? Who do they envisage? Who's going to go into this thing for non-profit? They do say they're profit people. I can understand they make rent. But who are the non-profit people? Then on page 11 of the presentation, they talk about, and I picked it up, the PFMA classification. They say it's not applicable. Now, I just want to understand that. Because if government funds are available, are involved here, then surely the PFMA must be applicable. Well, what are they trying to say here? But probably I didn't understand. Then on clause 5.C11, they talk that the municipalities have to provide access for social housing institutions. Two social housing institutions. If you just get to that five, if I wrote it down. Municipalities to provide access for social housing institutions to acquire municipal rental stock. Now, it comes again where Wasalga consulted in this, because this is a municipality. An asset. Can I just explain why they have to provide it and how is it going to be legislated? Because I mean it's assets of the municipality. I don't understand that. Then on the role and responsibilities of other role players, clause 6.1, hey, let's say the National Housing Finance Corporation must, and this is what the honorable member has raised here, in the space of social housing, provide access to loan funding. Now, is it the National Housing Finance Corporation going to set aside a certain amount for that, or is it going to be demand-driven? So that we don't find ourselves at the later stage that there was no funds available for this, because we have to... We're dealing with a 7% increase per annum here. Then just a last question. Some of these restructuring drugs already been declared? I think I heard something somewhere. That in some provinces, these things have been declared. But the bill is not even passed. Just clarification on that. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, Chairperson. At a very slow pace. The Social Housing Bill as amended by the Portfolio Committee on Housing. I don't know whether this does have another trend. Because usually it indicates before the preamble that the letters in bold or the sentences underlined, something is omitted, something is inserted. Unless if this is a total new deal, but according to how what I read as amended by the committee, I believe that trend should be followed. Like now when I really struggle, if I follow that trend, I would see what has been taken out and what has been put on to have it as an amended deal. But that is not the case if I look into this, unless I'm not looking correctly, unless somebody tells me to say, but it is the same trend. Am I clear, Captain, or I am making sense again?
No, you are making a lot of sense. I mean, if you had listened to when I presented the subject matter for today, I said social housing amendment bill precisely because of I read the same thing. But then when the presentation started, I didn't realize, but this is a new thing that is being presented to us as a select committee. Probably that's the question that we needed to get clarity on. Whether if, when the bill was introduced in the National Assembly, were the amendments made, and what are those amendments that were made by the portfolio committee. But on second thought, I just thought to myself, but it's quite clear that on this technical question, Mrs. Clapton in the first round, I don't want to say contest, but she made the point that some of these legal technical questions, they don't have a legal representative from the department. She would then have to go back to consult with them and so forth. Because coupled to that is the same issue that one has picked up even around the question of the applicability and non-applicability of the of the PSMA. Whereas if you look at the bill itself, under functions of the regulatory authority, you then note that from 2A up to 2C, there's a lot of emphasis on the accountability but adherence to the PSMA. And maybe just to pick up on one, C, yeah, that's 11.2C. It says, comply with the provisions of the Public Service Management Act and regulations applicable to public entities. But there's a lot of emphasis on the regulatory authority accounting to the minister and not parliament. Then you then begin to ask yourself, this regulatory authority, to what extent is it going to account to parliament? Or is it just going to account to the minister, and once it has accounted, it has submitted its personal plans to the minister, it ends there. Parliament's role is only as defined on the appointment of the committee of court, of the authority. But beyond that, parliament has got no role to play on the defined. Before you respond to, I've noted that it's quite a barrage of questions, and some of them quite serious comments that we would need clarity or comment from your side. Let's take, is it a follow-up? Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was going to raise my hand asking, at what stage does the legal advisors come in the committee when such a bill is presented? Just because sometimes with other bills, when the presentation of the bill is happening in the committee, the legal advisors supposed to be with us in order that we must not to get answers legal-wise. For instance, as the old reverend is asking, I'm thinking that we're supposed to have 29A and 29B having two bills. The other, yeah. Yes. So surely if the legal advisors, they were with you, they will immediately know that was to take something that is not happening. Maybe now we don't know whether you can answer that, just because we must say that in the A, it was the principal bill or whatever, the B is a version which amended. And then now this is the version which was amended to the list 1, 2, 3. So we don't have that. And really, one other time with another committee of, I don't know, we had to adjourn and say, call the legal advisors to come in, just because the ministers and ourselves were thinking that this is a very important piece of legislation and we cannot afford not to amend, not to pass. So I'm saying that there's something wrong with this presentation today. First and foremost, we have been listening, not saying that we are wrong, saying that we cannot answer some other question. They are too technical. So if they are too technical, you are supposed to have legal advice with us, with you and us. So I'm saying there's something wrong or that happened. I don't know how are we going to correct, just because we have this question, this is an urgent bill. But the agency, it was supposed to couple with every body from the office, that we must not say go and consult, just because now we have got questions that are not answerable. When are we going to have chance when we are going back to our provinces? Am I going to say, no, then this question we didn't get an answer just because legal advices were not in the committee?
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to allow some of the questions to be taken by Mr. Moholo, just to break the presentation as well. On the legal technicalities, yes, the state law advisor should have been here with me. So those technical issues on the bill process, the version of the bill, because I know there was one amendment from the portfolio committee, and that is then the bill that you should have. That I will follow up with the state law advisor and advise your office on the version, because there was an amendment from the portfolio committee to now. There weren't major amendments. There were some amendments to the bill. So I will get that technical information on the amendments and the specific Section 76 process that I will get from the state law advisor to your office. But on the other elements, I'll let Mr. Moholo start with some of the answering of the questions, and then I'll fill on top of him if that's in order.
Okay. Chairperson, I would like to start by saying that to in South Africa now, we have 10 years of social housing experience, and we should not overlook that. So whether, you know, we are well aware about what is happening in social housing or not, but at least we can have comfort in knowing that somewhere social housing has taken place. There are projects that we can point at that are social housing projects, and we can therefore start learning and interrogating the process and practice at those projects to inform whatever laws we want to come up with. Secondly, is that during that 10 years, it was 10 years of experimentation because you did not have social housing policy, nor did you have a social housing law in South Africa. So we allowed a situation where the social housing institutions were really pioneering and picking up the lessons so that later on then we could frame policy and frame legislation to guide social housing. And I think that is important, and this is where it comes from. This is where we say, then in 2006 we had the policy, and in 2007 framework legislation was being drafted. Secondly, let me say that as the foundation, we would offer our support to yourself if you go to provinces in whatever way to be with you to explain whatever concept you want to put across to your constituencies, so that it's not as confusing and frustrating as you pointed out to be. So you should also know that you have a resource that you can use to make your job easier for yourself. Coming to the question, just in terms of the differences between rental and social housing, I think the policy clarifies and the definition of social housing does emphasize the fact that it must be, if we're talking about social housing, we're talking about projects that are in such a manner, are built in such a manner that requires management, institutionalized management. So therefore, as an individual, if I do have a rental housing project, but I manage it as an individual, I should not then regard myself as a social housing institution. It's a purely rental project. Much as we have community residential units, which are rental projects. So what we are trying to distinguish is that the rental that you see in cities, owned by private firms, those are rentals. But where you invest public funds, state funds, to make it more affordable, you then are establishing social housing, and it has to conform to certain principles. These principles are then outlined in the policy, and I think in the section of the bill, it is quite clear as to what would make you qualify as a social housing institution. And the question was then raised about accreditation of projects or of institutions. You have to then comply with this requirement for us to be able to say to you, you are a social housing institution. And the project must also conform to the principles as outlined in the policy and the bill for it to be regarded as a social housing project. So you cannot just have a block of flats and call it social housing. We have to check it against the policy and the bill to say, but do you really conform to the principle? And if you do, yes, we say, yeah, it can be accredited. What has happened with the history that we have, because there is state funding, entrepreneurs come up and say, yes, I've got a social housing institution. Why? Because they want to access the funding, go and build the business, the flat, and get into property business without any regard to what the policy says, to what the expectations are. And probably that is where the rental tribunal then comes in to say, but somebody must come between the tenants and the landlord and start to deal with what issues really crop up there. And I think it's actually doing well in various instances where at least tenants who at times are seen as being exploited are able to stand up and go to someone to say, we've got a problem about this. But equally, landlords themselves to be able to go to someone to intervene in a situation where there are problems. However, with the Social Housing Regulatory Authority, what we are bringing in into the sector is an institution that will be able to, if you like, protect government investment in a real sense, where you say, yes, we'll give you funding to go and build and operate in a social housing context, but you must be able to be checked. We must know that you're doing what you have been asked to do, and you're reporting back to the regulatory authority. If the regulatory authority sees it fit that there should be an intervention, they should then be free to be able to intervene in that instance. And I think these lessons come from our experience at the Social Housing Foundation. We'll be able to work with institutions, build capacity. But whatever they do, we are not able to stop them. We're not able to say, hey, but this is not how you're supposed to deal with this. Your board is not functioning, or your board is made up in a wrong way. Why? Because we did not have legislative power. And when you look at investors say, but why should we be investing in an unregulated environment? We're just wasting our money, because these guys can just mismanage the property, the project, and they'll not be accountable to anybody. So there is that context around the introduction of the regulatory authority. However, the regulatory authority must also work with the provinces and with the ministry to guide where investment has to happen. To say, yes, in that area, that's a developing area, Kuka is a developing area, there has to be social housing. Province agrees with that. The local authority there also participates. So it's actually all parties being involved in doing that. But those decisions, some of the decisions are really taken at province and implemented at local level. At national level, the national really opens up the environment to make sure that developments do take place. Then the regulatory authority, having done the investment, will have to make sure that those are protected, make sure that they monitor the projects. The projects are well managed, the projects are viable on an ongoing basis, and there is progress. So I think that is the first part. Secondly, is to build ongoing capacity of the players in the social housing process. You have provinces, you have local authorities, but you have the delivery agents themselves. So the regulatory authority will have to find a way of making sure that that capacity is built on an ongoing basis and the project succeeds. When we talk about private sector and cross-subsidization, all that it means really is that there is funding being made available for the development of social housing. Within the target group, there are those people who would qualify, who earn within the targeted bracket, which is 7,500 downwards. Those people would then qualify for that subsidy. But we are talking about projects that are in well-located areas, where even myself, who's earning more than 7,500, would wish to go and stay there. And we are saying, yes, you are allowed to go and stay there, but you don't qualify for a subsidy. Therefore, you are paying a full rent. And that actually makes it even more accessible to people who are earning below, because the institution or the management agent can look at how they set their rent to make sure that those who are paying higher rent, some of that money gets distributed and helps the project to survive. And it is very important. What is important is that you don't want to just lump low-income earners on their own without them living with other people who are earning a higher salary. And the concept of cross-subsidization deals with that. Those people who qualify and those people who are earning above but who want to stay in those places. The same with the issue of profit companies. Really, by profit companies, yes, you're talking about banks. There are banks that are developers. You're talking about other private sector institutions. However, the intention is to bring capacity within the sector. We don't have a lot of capacity. It is not really attractive for people who are waiting really on profit to do business there, because some of the rentals do not give them so much profit. So we might have to find a way of how do we make them get into the sector, but also to increase our own capacity. Because what we are talking about, this is for people who don't have a lot of financial capacity or funding capacity, and you want to get the big
players also assisting the sector to develop. The PPPs, they could do a project jointly, and there is a mechanism that is outlined as to how PPPs are structured by Treasury. I think I've spoken about accredited projects and accredited institutions. In the Eastern Cape, we do have a number of projects, fortunately. There is about 7 projects of social housing, especially in Buffalo City. I think it's the second largest region in social housing terms. And there is a lot of social housing experience that is there. So in terms of the relationship with social housing and hostels or CRUs, they are complementary. I think CRUs or hostels, CRU program is targeting those who are earning even much lower than people who would qualify for social housing projects.
Can I just intervene? Because my question is being answered, but without being understood.
Okay.
See, let's just go back to the slide in 7 and 13. 7 says non-profit companies, municipal owned entities, and housing offices are social housing institutions. But now, reading that in the context of the one on page 13, chapter 4, it means they are, yes, but they only become when they have been accredited. Is that correct? But then how can a for-profit company and a private enterprise become accredited as an SHI if they are not recognized as SHI in terms of your slide on page 7?
Just to clarify on that, the bill and what the regulator will be regulating primarily is social housing institutions, as you correctly point out. So the SHRA will be able to intervene and will oversee social housing institutions, which are those three entities. In most cases, they're non-profit entities, and that's why SHRA needs to be able to intervene directly in them. But there is an element of accredited projects as well. And in accredited projects, which is not the entity being accredited, but the project, that is where your for-profit company would play a role and your PPP. So in the one case, institutions will be accredited, which the SHRA will then have direct intervention and oversight on. In the other case, where you can't have direct intervention and oversight, for example, a PPP, you can't have direct intervention and oversight on a PPP. We have accredited projects. And the SHRA will then have oversight through the accredited projects for for-profit companies and public-private partnerships. And that's how it will manage it.
Then they become SHI.
They don't necessarily have to become SHIs because we've got oversight and control over the project. But it's because there's a non-profit stream, which is SHRA's main focus, then there is a for-profit stream, and they have to be treated a little bit different. The one is through accredited institutions. The other one is through accredited projects, and that's how we manage the two sides of the coin. Because we can't, for the for-profit companies, also intervene in the same way as in a non-profit or not-for-gain company, if that helps you clarify.
Are those that have been approved by national, provincial, and local?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's see you, Chair. If that be so, how can you then say on your slide that only accredited SHIs may participate in the national social housing program? If indeed the for-profits and the PPPs can also become accredited?
The for-profit and the PPPs won't be accredited. Their projects will be accredited. Because they are not for-profit companies.
Maybe for...
But they're still participating in the program.
No. It also may be an opportunity for entrepreneurs like yourself. That is why I'm trying to open up for us to engage and test our own understanding of the issue. The way I understand the presentation, it says, here are these institutions that are accredited, recognized as the only accredited. But over and above that, there are projects that would also be accredited by the regulatory authority. But these projects, for them to be accredited, they have to be approved. And for them to be approved, We've got money that government has put in. National government, provincial government, your local authorities or municipalities. Is that understanding correct? Is there somebody who still does not understand it?
Honorable Padre, why will somebody go into a project and not be a committed to the institution of the legislation? Why will somebody do that?
Let me explain. The non-profit companies, they do not have money of their own. They have to go to a bank, raise funds. They have to go and get government money, plus through the program they get capacity building support.
That's cost. That's a cost.
Yes. But they get that support and then they can go and do the project. But by getting that support, the SHRA has direct control and can intervene in them if they don't perform. Then you get the accredited project, which can be done by a for-profit company that has its own money, that can go overseas and raise money and bring it here and says, well, I don't want to be completely controlled by the SHRA, but you can control my project, and I'm putting my own money.
But why would you ask me to control my project? Why would you do that?
No, you need to protect and control the project so that they don't speculate on the project and run away with the government funding, to use the government funding to speculate. So that's why you would look after the project.
No, it's a process. We will understand. I mean, it is necessary and important for us to understand. I think we had already agreed earlier on that we will obviously have to take the two areas and combine them for purposes of our own clarity. You had further, Ntatimo, committed yourself with the foundation capacity and the human resource that is available to assist us in further understanding this. We have not even resolved the legal, technical aspect in terms of how we are going to process this thing. Because what is bothering me now is where to from here. Having started in the manner that we had started without proper understanding and so forth. Would it be legally correct or procedurally correct to go and brief provinces within the framework of the cycle without having this clarity in terms of the bills that should have been presented to us and so forth? I think that's a matter that we would then have to clarify to ourselves as a committee. I mean, if push comes to show, we cannot, much as we understand the urgency, but what would be the point of us doing the wrong thing? You know? We would end up again with this constitutional ruling where we will have to come back again to parliament and so forth. And these are some of the things that are causing a serious bad impression or creating a bad impression about us as legislators. And we cannot continue to commit such mistakes. And we will appreciate the presentation. Once you will be consulting, we will also definitely have to consult and check whether if procedure is correct. And if not, then we will have to deal with the bill in the next term. That there's nothing that we'll be able to do. We would have loved to see this thing also taking off the ground. We understand the conditions and the problems that our people are facing outside there with this unregulated housing industry and problems that are taking place in within and amongst our people. So we might have to, and I'm saying we shouldn't treat this as an exhaustive process. We shouldn't treat it like that. There will be those hanging questions. You would supply us with further information and so forth with that political context that you were getting us to. It would form a very important base also on the presentation, which members feel that it's too technical and so forth. But maybe if you can loosen it up a bit, Mrs. Crafton. I know, maybe. She said, no, you are going. Because you see, some of these things are great, not difficult for members to understand, but I know the key question is, how am I going to present it? Because to understand it is easy for me, but how am I going to present it to an ordinary person if I have to convene public hearings and so forth. So let's take Babamsizi and maybe conclude on this matter, because I think at a principle level we won't be able to answer. Okay.
Okay, I'll do that. It was outside the right. Chapter started this morning. We complained about the heat. And somebody was going to be called to come and check the right, maybe the system and the fan. But something struck my mind. I wasn't here when they were debating in the NAD. Said about the power of failure and all those things. There is a note which was circulated that says, among other things, that fans and many other things should not be used. We should open windows, open doors. Is it not the policy now being applied there? Our regulators now have now closed. We can no longer listen. Once a regulator closes, nothing goes out. Nothing comes in.
The problem with that, since they've introduced air conditioners, they don't like opening windows anymore.
Well, I take it that when the building was constructed, the challenge, it's part of this growing economy. We didn't anticipate the challenges that will come. It's a matter that we will have maybe to see how we get out of it as MPs. But what is important, obviously, is that you are raising, which is out of now the briefing, is that we have been put to put this whole thing, the 10-point saving mechanism, into practice. And maybe it's a good way of starting, because we'll do it more often at home. But if you could do it in this enclosure, so you can do it at home. And let's save electricity and reorganize our country and let's have a better time. Okay. Honourable members, I think we have agreed on the process that we would appreciate the presentation as presented, as given to us. Of course, with the commitment that the department has done. I must also confess, it was a serious oversight. And I think maybe because of it's our first official meeting in the year to deal with such heavy stuff, that all of us, and especially me, I would take responsibility for that, to have allowed a bill to be presented even without the presence of the legal advisors. That should have been the first question that should have been put to the department. Where are the official, the departmental legal advisors? Over and above the state law, legal advisors, or whatsoever. But from the department, we should have had someone. Because this is a bill that comes from their department. So therefore, any clarity must, in actual fact, in the first instance, be provided by the department. The state law advisor will come in if there is a misunderstanding or a dispute between us as a committee and the department, either on interpretation or whatsoever, then when they will come in. But I think one must take responsibility. It was a serious oversight to have done that. But also, opportunistically, it was a good thing, because probably the meeting would have stopped there. The meeting might not have proceeded, and we would not have had the benefit of having this briefing. So on the other side, we will take advantage of the briefing. But thank you very much, Dr. Moore and Mrs. Crafton, and I hope that you would relate the committee's frustration in the context that we were putting to you as officials from the department. And then let me take the opportunity to attend the meeting, because we had agreed on a quick 2 minutes discussion on this matter, but excuse you, obviously we will be in contact with you. Okay, thank you very much. is the thing. Because of two honest people. Okay, numbers. Maybe it's just a quick thing. I'm aware that there's a program that has been adopted at the program committee meeting this morning. But that program is not the annual program that we were given last year and in January that assisted us to have a proposal. Now you have adopted another program because we were not even aware that on the 21st, Mpumalanga would be 22nd. So that is why we have the 21st.
But on the old program, it was 21-22, always Thursday and Friday. And even if a province has their national address on a Friday, you'll get nobody on the Thursday, especially not in the afternoon.
They were blessed with the presence of the Honorable Suleiman, who is the head of programming. He's the programming whip. Honorable Suleiman, you came at the right time because we were just beginning to grapple with this problem that is here before us. One, we are informed reliably and not by a source, but a member of the committee's whip. To say there's a program that was adopted this morning, which says that on the 13th to the 15th, provinces will be briefed on this bill that we're dealing with today. But if you look at the national program around the opening of legislature, 14th and 15th, there are provinces, two if not three, that will be open. And as permanent delegates from our respective provinces, it is only fair and correct that members must be in the opening of their legislature. That's the first part. Second part, we have just concluded the presentation, and we have realized that there are serious technical problems that came out of the presentation. The absence of the state law advisor, the absence of the departmental legal advisor, who denied us, therefore, as a result of the absence, an opportunity to engage in, with some legal aspect, presentation of the bill, because it's only now that we realize that in actual fact, there were amendments that were done to the bill by the National Assembly. So the bill that was put to us was the wrong bill. So it's just clear that we won't be able to finalize this bill within this quarter as it was requested for us to deal with. So those are the two major issues that we are grappling with as a committee. I don't know if you can assist us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairperson. Just to say that you were briefed on the wrong bill tells me that you never received the briefing. That's point number one. Point number two is that seeing that provincial legislatures are going to open and members are expected to be there, I accept that. I think what we need to do perhaps is, Chair, is to apply our minds to the program as to how to approach this particular piece of legislation. But I'm sure we can't do it here in detail, but we can meet after this meeting, yourself, the work of the committee, the secretary, myself, and so on. So let us apply our minds to that and take all these things into consideration and come up with a proper plan as to how to approach this bill. Thank you.
Will you, Chair, in doing so, also bear in mind that in Mpumalanga,
is the 21, the 22nd, but the 21st is also out. I mean, you can't go and brief on the Thursday afternoon before the opening of the program. Yeah. My heart is not doing it.
Okay, now it's understood. So, are we agreed with the with the quota?
On our list.
Are we then saying that the parking has come back? Yes. Yeah.
So the cycle
hasn't
started today.
Okay.
No.
That's exactly what the
chairperson
said.
Okay.
No, thank you very much,
honorable members.
Hello.
No, I was looking at the problem. Did you discuss the problem?
Yeah,
Or was the interesting just which oh, this is a program of housing. When you are saying 27 March, you can take oversight visit. We want it in order that we must know.
Oh, yeah, that is public service. It's around the NHBRC houses that have been demolished or that were reported to be demolished in the Eastern Cape, so we wanted to. But in any case, I mean, if things were normal, I would have given a clear presentation of the program. Sorry, brother, for having come all the way.